Jack McCabe took the cell phone from the clip on his belt, opened it, and thumbed the speed dial button that would connect him with Terry's phone. Just as he heard the ringing on the other end, people started to yell nearby. He wasn't far from the electronics area, and as people started to run in that direction, McCabe swung his gaze after them and saw the 24 or so television sets lined up in display rows on shelves were all tuned to the same thing. The screens, including several large high-definition plasma units, all showed flames and a cloud of smoke, shot from a high angle that told McCabe the video feed came from a news chopper. His jaw tightened. Something bad had happened. Really bad. Terry wasn't answering her phone. McCabe closed his. Still holding it, he reached out with his other hand and grasped the arm of a man who was hurrying past him, away from the display of TV sets.
Hey, what's going on?
Explosions all over the north side of Fort Worth. Some sort of terrorist attack. They said on TV that a bank had been blown up. My wife works in a bank. I've got to call her.
McCabe let the man go. Poor bastard was scared out of his wits. McCabe couldn't blame him. Obviously, this news story just broke. There wouldn't be many details available yet. Chances were the guy's wife was all right. There were dozens of banks in the area, maybe more than 100. But right now, he couldn't be sure. McCabe forced his way through the crowd of people gathering in front of the TV sets, and he got close enough so that he could see the crawl going along the bottom of the screen on one of the big plasma units, under the footage of a burning building with a debris field around it that looked like something from a war zone. McCabe stiffened, and sickness punched into his gut as he read there were reports of a post office and a daycare center bombing, as well as the bank. There was also a fourth explosion near a police station. McCabe's jaw was tight with anger and horror. He spent long years of his life fighting bastards who did this sort of thing, but ever since 9/11, they kept their cowardly acts on their own turf. Now their madness was back on American soil. Of course, there was always a chance the terror was domestic, not foreign. McCabe recalled Oklahoma City. But every instinct in his body, all of them honed by his experiences in the Shadow Wars, told him that these atrocities were the work of Islamic terrorists. The multiple strikes timed to go off together, the choice of soft civilian targets. Those were the hallmarks of an attack planned by Al-Qaeda or one of the other Islamic groups. McCabe was out of the loop long enough, so he wasn't sure which bunch of psychotic bastards represented the biggest threat to the United States these days. It didn't really matter who did it. The terrible truth was, they hit us again. McCabe felt like he wanted to puke. What would we do about it this time? That was the question. Would the liberal politicians and the mainstream media get out of the way and stay out of the way while the people who were trained and equipped to deal with threats like this did their job? McCabe doubted it. Based on the evidence of the past decade or so, somewhere the country lost its will to stomp the snakes that needed stomping. The thought made McCabe almost as sick at the thought of all the innocent lives snuffed out this morning in a burst of hatred, born of insanity. The phone he still clutched in his hand vibrated. He lifted it, looked at the display. Terry, thank God. Right now, in this time of tragedy, he wanted more than ever to be with his wife and daughter.
Hey, babe, where are you?
But it wasn't his wife's voice he heard on the phone. Ellis Burke didn't know what was going on. One minute he had been trying to think of a way to get Terry McCabe and her daughter to buzz off and leave him alone with Allison. Well, as alone as you could get when the two of you were surrounded by hundreds of yokels and yahoos anyway. And the next moment, people were carrying on like something terrible had happened. Burke supposed that was true. Something terrible had happened. He heard somebody talking about an explosion and had a bad moment when he thought something blew up here in the store. Maybe the place was on fire and he would either burn to death or get trampled in the redneck stampede. Then he realized they were talking about something they saw on the television sets in the electronics department, which was a good third of the way across the store from where he, Allison, and the McCabe women were. Bad news traveled fast. Allison turned and clutched at his arm. Burke had hoped all morning that sooner or later she would touch him, though grabbing him in panic wasn't exactly what he had in mind. Anything was better than nothing.
My God, did you hear that? Did somebody say something about a daycare center being blown up?
Burke felt a stab of genuine worry.
Your little boy, is he?
No, thank God, my neighbor babysits him. He doesn't go to daycare.
Oh, then he's all right.
Yes, but all those other children, it's horrible. Just horrible.
Burke agreed, of course. But whatever tragedy happened, there was nothing he could do about it. And his daughter didn't go to daycare either, so he didn't see how it could affect him personally. Still, he started to put his arms around Ellison to comfort her. He would have, too, if Terry McCabe hadn't swooped in like a hawk and embraced her first, turning her away from Burke.
It'll be all right.
But it wouldn't be for a lot of families. Burke had heard people saying that explosions occurred in other places, too, like a bank and a post office. A lot of people must have died in those blasts. Banks and post offices were busy places. And, of course, so were daycare centers. The death toll might reach into the hundreds. It was a sobering thought. And a chilling thought came with it. Multiple explosions didn't happen at the same time by accident, especially directed at specific targets like that. This was terrorism, pure and simple. Burke wasn't the only one to come to that conclusion.
By God, we need to go over there and nuke every one of them Arab countries back to the Stone Age.
Hell, I'll sign up to go right now. I'd rather kill those damn camel jockeys up close and personal, though.
A wave of revulsion went through Burke at the sound of the racist, hate-filled rants.
Hold on, hold on. We don't know who did this. We don't know yet who's responsible.
Well, it had to be them ding-dang Muslims, because they're behind everything, just like on 9/11.
Oh, what about Timothy McVeigh? After Oklahoma City, I heard people saying the same sort of things about Muslims, and it turned out they didn't have a thing to do with that.
Now, this is different. Al-Qaeda did this, sure as hell.
Or one of those other terrorist groups.
They were all ignorant bumpkins, jumping to the easiest, most hateful conclusions. Typical Red State behavior. As far as Burke was concerned, reactions like that were more dangerous to the country than all the Islamic terrorists combined. He hated to think about what was going to happen over the next few days. Mosques would be vandalized, peaceful, innocent Muslim Americans would be harassed, or worse. The way most Americans acted at times like this, Burke could understand why the rest of the world hated us. He was so incensed and morally outraged over the unfairness of it all that for the moment he forgot about Allison Sawyer and the hopes he had of talking her into having lunch with him. Then he remembered her and looked around, fearing she might have slipped away in the crowd. To his relief, he saw that she was still there. Settled down a little, she didn't look quite so panic-stricken and upset now. Terry McCabe lifted her cell phone.
I'm going to try and call your father back. Maybe he's somewhere here in the store.
Burke was trying to figure out a way to ease Allison away from the McCabes when he looked over Terry's shoulder and saw something that, for a second, his brain refused to comprehend or even admit he was really seeing. Then, with a shake of his head, he realized it was real. A tall, dark-complexioned man with black hair and a neatly trimmed beard opened his long, bulky jacket and was reaching for a couple of guns strapped to his body. Burke recognized the weapons vaguely as some sort of machine pistols. They had to be toys of some sort. Yeah, that was it. Toys the guy was trying to shoplift for his kids. Poor bastard was probably out of a job because the heartless corporation he worked for downsized and outsourced all its personnel. Corporate executives were the real terrorists.
Everyone down! On the floor now, or I'll kill you! Everyone down!
We interrupt our regular programming to bring you this special bulletin from Dallas, Texas. The Associated Press is reporting a series of explosions rocked the suburbs north of Fort Worth approximately 15 minutes ago. We're told the powerful blasts destroyed several buildings, including a bank, a post office, and a daycare center. The death toll from these explosions is expected to be high. At this point, we have no information on what caused the blasts, whether they were tragic accidents or deliberate acts of violence. No group has stepped forward to claim responsibility. The government is said to be monitoring the websites of suspicious organizations, both foreign and domestic. We expect more information soon. What's that? We have a correspondent from our network affiliate in Dallas on the line for an update on this situation. Hello, can you hear me? Can you tell us what's happened down there?
The Little Friends Daycare Center. It's all gone. It's as if the center was never here. It's just a crater in the ground.
The president muted the TV. She wanted to put her hands over her face and shut out the sight of what she was seeing on the television in the Oval Office. If she couldn't see it, maybe it wasn't really there. This couldn't be happening on her watch. It just couldn't. But of course it was. and no amount of denial would make it go away.
We shouldn't have let the Israelis do it. And once they did, we shouldn't have sided with them.
The National Security Advisor sat across the desk from the president. She was in the White House when word of the explosions in Texas started to spread. She was there because of the terror alert based on the intel from Pakistan. Fresh intel just arrived, pinpointing the locations of the attacks. But it came too late to save any of the people in the leveled bank, post office, and daycare center.
Ugh, this is all my fault.
The president and the NSA were the only ones in the Oval Office at the moment.
Nonsense. The Iranians didn't do this.
The president looked around at her.
Do we know who did?
Hizbut Tahrir.
Who's that?
The president had a reputation for being extremely intelligent, the sort of policy wonk who knew everything about everything. That only held true for subjects she found interesting, like social policies. Foreign policy and defense meant little to her.
Hizbut Tahrir is a pan-Islamic terror group similar to Al-Qaeda. They've always kept a low profile until recently. Now, though, they're poised to take the lead in the terror campaign against the West. Their goal is to eventually unite all the Muslim nations and do away with the individual governments, leading to the rise of what they refer to as the Caliphate, a Muslim superstate to rule the planet.
But that's insane.
Everybody's got to start somewhere.
The president looked at the TV again.
You're sure these people are behind what's happening in Texas?
Positive. The CIA just received an encrypted transmission from one of its agents in Islamabad. Another operative discovered the plans for this strike during a raid on a Hizbut Tahrir training facility on the border between Pakistan and Afghanistan.
The president glanced sharply at her.
We're still conducting covert missions in that area? I thought I made it clear. America was no longer going to wage war in the shadows. Everything has to be clean, open, and above board.
Now that was a recipe for certain disaster, the NSA thought, and she was glad certain people in government, including the vice president and the president's husband, realized it. Without some careful skirting of certain executive orders, the country might be conducting its official business in Arabic by now. The NSA knew that. The president didn't, or chose not to consider it. But the president probably slept better at night. At least, until now. Until hell broke loose in Texas. The NSA ignored the other woman's sanctimonious glare and got back to the subject at hand.
I repeat, the Iranians didn't do this. Hizbut Tahrir may be planning on using the heightened tensions in the Middle East as the excuse for this new terror offensive, but they would have done it sooner or later anyway. They've been biding their time, but they believe now is the moment to begin the rise of the Caliphate.
What can we do to stop them?
That was a question that should have been asked and answered long before now. The NSA smiled thinly.
We can try to get ahead of them so something like this doesn't happen again.
The president gestured toward the TV screen.
But what about Texas?
The NSA shook her head.
It's too late for us to stop whatever is happening there. Whatever is going on, the only ones who can do anything about it are the ones on the scene.
The president gave in to the urge and covered her face with her hands.
Oh!
Walt Graham was on the phone with the director of the FBI when Eileen Bastrop hurried into his office and put a note on his desk.
Yes, sir. I'll give you a direct report on the situation just as soon as I can. I'm on my way out of the office right now. I'll be on the scene shortly.
Graham looked at the note. It read, "The press is here." The burly SAC made a face. He hung up the phone.
Back door?
They're probably there, too, damn buzzards.
Shouldn't talk that way about the intrepid guardians of our freedom.
I thought the people who guarded our freedom were the ones on the front lines.
Shows how little you know.
Graham grinned, but there was no real humor on his face. His eyes were hard and bleak. He got the encrypted transmission from Langley, since he was the SAC of the FBI office, closest to the terrorists' target. The company's covert ops guy in Pakistan identified the Ultra Megamart as the place where the scumbags intended to strike. But even as Graham was about to send a desperate warning to local law enforcement, bulletins started to come in about the devastating car bombings in the suburbs just north of Fort Worth. The CIA agent in Pakistan didn't mention anything about them. Either there was some miscommunication somewhere, or the source of the intel just hadn't known about the other bombings. Or the business about the Ultra Megamart being the target was just false intel, a deliberate decoy. Graham ran all those scenarios through his mind. Then, hard on the heels of the reports about the bombings, came the news that shots were fired inside the big discount store, and Graham knew the truth. The bombings were nothing but a prelude to the main attack, just something to get the attention of the government, the news media, the public, and let them know the terrorists were serious about their demands. And there would be demands. There always were in hostage situations. Even without being on the scene yet, Graham knew that that was what was developing at the Ultra Megamart north of Fort Worth. Graham motioned for Bastrop to follow him and left the office through a rear door that led to a corridor through a service area, ending up outside where the Bureau's extra cars were parked. As Graham and Bastrop emerged into the sunny but chilly day, Graham was relieved to see that the reporters and camera crews weren't back here yet. He glanced up, though, and saw a news chopper circling overhead. Within seconds, the pilot would be radioing down to his associates on the ground that somebody was slipping out of the FBI office by the back door. Sure enough, a camera crew charged around the corner of the federal building a moment later, but by that time, Graham and Bastrop were in one of the spare cars. Graham was behind the wheel. He drove out fast, leaving the news hounds behind. He didn't know if they got close enough to recognize him in Bastrop. If so, they would probably follow. It didn't really matter. He and the assistant SAC were on their way to the scene. There would already be dozens of media people there. The grand opening of the Ultra Megamart was a big story all by itself. If bloodthirsty terrorists had already taken over the place, then it would soon be the biggest story since 9/11. Hamed's heart pounded wildly in his chest. He never felt such exultation as what now coursed through him at the sight of those terrified infidel faces as he fired his machine pistols into the ceiling. Fluorescent light fixtures burst under the assault of lead like fireworks, showering the crowd with fine bits of glass and plastic. As Hamed lowered the weapons, people dived for the floor. Nearly everyone in the crowd around him obeyed his shouted orders. One woman, a lean blonde about 40 years old, glared at him and stayed on her feet longer than the others, but then a younger woman with her reached up, grabbed her arm, and dragged her down to the floor.
Do what he says, Mom! Do what he says!
Near that pair, a man in a business suit stared for a second as if he couldn't comprehend what he was seeing, but as Hamed started to swing the barrel of his right-hand gun toward the man, the infidel's beefy face paled, and he dove to the floor next to a fair-haired young woman. The man put his arms over his head, as if that would protect him from a storm of bullets if Hamed chose to unleash one. The only thing the infidels possessed in greater quantity than arrogance was stupidity.
No one move! Everyone, stay down! Eyes on the floor!
He knew that others were crying out the same orders in other parts of the store. It would have been better if their numbers were larger, of course. They were a mere 20 believers against a horde of infidels, 22 if you counted Sheikh al-Mukhari and Shalasahi, who made good on her insistence she participate in their holy mission. Those 22 were warriors in a holy cause. They were opposed by American sheep too cowardly to fight back. If the events of the past decade demonstrated anything, it was that American resolve was weak and would crumble at the first sign of danger. That was why the minions of the great Satan were destined to lose every conflict. Not only were the Americans followers of false prophets, they were cowards. A few among them were aberrations, however. Like the man who suddenly rushed toward Hamed from behind, the fool moved like a water buffalo. Courage was not enough to protect him. Hamed heard him coming in plenty of time to swing halfway around, heft his left-hand gun. The steel-jacketed slugs punched into the man and stopped his charge. He went over backward instead, blood spraying from a half a dozen wounds as he fell. His bullet-riddled body landed on several people who were trying frantically to get out of the way.
You see what will happen if anyone tries to oppose us?
The Americans were disoriented. Now it was time to demoralize them even more than they already were.
Anyone who disobeys will die! Allahu Akbar!
Now Hamed heard something more satisfying than screams of fear. The sound of weeping. Despair was spreading among the captives. That meant that most of the battle was won, at least in this section of the store. The Americans were giving up, in hopes that their pathetic lives would be spared. They couldn't imagine that they were all doomed. Hamed, Nukari, Shala, they all knew that they would never leave the Ultra Megamart alive. In the end, it would not even matter whether the American president agreed to Hizbut Tahrir's demands. No, the real victory would come in a moment of searing nuclear bliss, taking the lives of hundreds of Americans, leaving a gaping radioactive crater in the North Texas prairie as an eternal monument to the ultimate fate of all infidels. The act would be the final legacy of this day, a day of death and destruction to haunt Americans for all time. There was nothing they could do to prevent it. Nothing. McCabe pressed his back against the wall of the cavernous, high-ceilinged stockroom running along the rear of the Ultra Megamart from one end of the store to the other. He hunkered low behind a stack of big-screen televisions in their thick cardboard cartons. The terrorist machine gunner missed him in the initial sweep through the stockroom. Then the guy herded all the employees who were back here into the far end so he could keep them contained. The terrorist had no idea McCabe was here, and McCabe intended to keep it that way, for now at least. He had to take stock of the situation, gather some intel, figure out just how bad things were, and then decide what to do about them. His mind began replaying everything that happened in the past few minutes, the interminably long time since he first heard the gunfire through the cell phone. His first reaction was that of a husband, fear for his wife's safety. He didn't know where Terry was, only that she was somewhere in the store. He wanted to hurry to her side and make sure she was all right. But he couldn't do that because he had no idea of her location, and after a second, the connection broke, as if she'd snapped the phone shut. McCabe didn't need the phone to hear the shots then. They were sounding all over the store, along with shouted commands and cries of fear. His training and years of experience kicked in as he listened to that unholy racket. He knew what he was hearing. Gunmen were taking over the store, taking everyone in here hostage. The automatic weapons fire came in short bursts, designed to terrify and force compliance, not the continuous unholy roar of a massacre in progress. McCabe was moving, even as that realization came to him. Here in the electronics section, nobody was shooting yet, so he still had time to act. Probably just a matter of seconds, though. As everybody else watched the horrible news on TV, began shouting frightened questions and milling around, McCabe moved toward the wall and slid along the display of television sets until he reached a small door. Though this was his first time in the store, he knew enough of the basic Megamart design to know that the door would lead to a short corridor running back to the stockroom. While large merchandise, such as the TVs themselves, came out through one of the sets of swinging double doors between the main room and the stockroom, smaller items could be retrieved through this access hallway. Nobody saw him duck through the door. The door barely swung closed behind him when he heard the shots on the other side of it, not far away. The terrorist assigned to take over this part of the store was just a little slow getting into action. Maybe the guns the bastard hid under his coat snagged or something. The reason didn't matter. What was important was that McCabe wasn't a prisoner, yet. He had to stay free as long as he could. Otherwise, he couldn't do anything to save his wife, his daughter, and all the other innocent people in the store. The civilian truck driver was gone now, vanished in those bursts of gunfire. Jackknife was back. People thought it was just his nickname, because his name was Jack and he drove a truck. Jackknife was also his handle. Only a handful of people, Terry and the surviving members of his unit, the men he worked with for so long, knew it was also his call sign. The only name he used when he and the team were operating behind enemy lines, in dangerous situations. The first step in beating the enemy was to think like the enemy. If he was a terrorist, how would he go about taking over a store as big as the Ultra Megamart? How many people would he need, and how would they be armed? He heard the automatic weapons fire, a partial answer. If they were homegrown terrorists, which was possible, even though the fringe militia and white supremacist movements died down in recent years, chances were all they had were the guns. But if they were Islamic, they probably carried bombs too, maybe even strapped to their bodies. Islamic terrorists loved it when stuff blew up real good, McCabe recalled. He wasn't sure what that said about them psychologically. He didn't give a crap either, except as for how their psychology related to their mission, and his. Islamic terrorists were likely to go to any lengths to achieve their goals, even to the point of blowing themselves up. That fanaticism made them more dangerous, but sometimes it could be turned against them. McKay put the question of their identity aside for a moment as he tried to figure the odds. Even a well-trained group, operating with military precision, would require quite a few members to take over a target as big as this store. Say, 24, give or take, McCabe decided. More would be better, but they might have to make do with what they had. Sleeper agents, possibly smuggled into the United States. Though it was certainly possible some of them held legal work or student visas. Despite its best efforts, a free country couldn't keep all of its enemies out. So he was looking at odds of 20-1 at a bare minimum. Not good, but if he could whittle them down a little, well, what choice did he have but to try? Terry and Ronnie were in here somewhere, probably scared out of their wits. Not to mention hundreds of other innocent folks who got up from their beds today with nothing more on their minds than doing some shopping at the grand opening of the new Ultra Mega Mart. All those thoughts went through his head in the mere seconds it took him to reach the door at the other end of the corridor. Instead of grasping the knob, he pressed his ear against the steel panel and listened intently. He hoped the terrorists weren't back here yet, so he might have a chance to organize some resistance among the guys working in the stockroom.
Close those doors now! Close those doors and lock them! Close them or die!
When he heard the big loading dock doors on the back of the store going down, he knew he was too late. The sounds moved off to McCabe's left. At least one of the terrorists got into the stockroom somehow, and now was rounding up the workers. McCabe remembered the guy he'd passed as he left the stockroom a few minutes earlier. At the time, McCabe didn't pay much attention to him, but now he brought the man's image to mind. Stocky, a little below medium height, with a broad, swarthy face, dark curly hair, and a mustache. Was he Hispanic? Middle Eastern? Middle Eastern, McCabe decided. Not as common in this part of the country as someone of Hispanic origin, but certainly not uncommon. Some of them belonged to families in this country for generations, while others were more recent immigrants. Many were naturalized citizens, honest, hardworking, law-abiding Americans. But not that particular guy, McCabe was willing to wager. He even wore a thick, fairly long jacket, just the sort of garment for hiding weapons. What were you gonna do? Set up metal detectors at every entrance? Pat down all the shoppers as they came in? Yeah, that would be good for business. Running risks was part of being free. McCabe knew that. At this moment, though, he wished something could have been done to stop those sons of bitches before they ever got in here. He was sure the guy he saw hung around back in the stockroom for a few minutes, stalling for time, asking dumb questions of the supervisor or something, until the terrorists inside the main store made their move.
Down, you pigs! See how you treat us, you spawn of Satan! Down! Silent pig dog!
Since the shouts were coming from the far end of the stockroom now, McCabe eased the door open an inch or so and peered out.
Down! 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 I said get down! All of you, get down!
Nobody was moving in his line of sight. He saw heavy metal shelves with stacks of boxed DVD players, boom boxes, and other electronics gear. He opened the door a little wider and saw stacks of boxed-up big-screen TVs. There was a small gap between the crates and the wall. McCabe slipped into it, intending to move along the space until he might be able to get a look at the terrorist and the hostages. Then he heard a footstep nearby and slid down into the deeper shadow that obscured part of his narrow gap. One of the boxes wasn't shoved over completely against the one next to it. He was able to peer through the tiny opening. He saw a man walk past, a machine pistol in each hand. McCabe didn't get a good look at his face, just enough to see the short, dark beard and the piercing black eyes.
We have them all. I did not see anyone else.
Well, the accent settled the question of the terrorists' identities. He was dealing with Islamic fanatics, the sort of men who would go to any lengths to get what they wanted, because they held a bill of goods from the crazed sheikhs, mullahs, and ayatollahs who led them. They believed they were doing the will of their God and were willing, even eager, to die as martyrs for their cause. In a true war, such single-minded devotion to duty was admirable, even on the part of the enemy. But these so-called freedom fighters didn't make war on other soldiers. They made war on women, children, the elderly, and infirm. They targeted the most helpless in society. McCabe recalled the news bulletin he saw a few minutes earlier. God, only a few minutes? It seemed longer. about the bombing of the daycare center. A perfect example of the evil perpetrated by these monsters. That was why they had to be stopped. McCabe's instinct warned him, and he turned, twisting in the narrow space. He tried to get room somehow to fight, but too late, too rusty from the years of soft living. Even in the dim light, he knew he was staring into the barrel of a gun. Terry felt her daughter Ronnie trembling as she lay on the floor with an arm around her. The maternal instinct to protect her child was irresistible, even though Terry knew her arm wouldn't shield Ronnie if the madman decided to shoot them. Her mind was half stunned by the shocking, sudden developments inside the Ultra Mega Mart. Like most Americans in these perilous times, Terry McCabe had thought about what it might be like if she was caught in the middle of a terrorist attack. Even so, like most Americans, she didn't really expect it would happen. She was lulled by the knowledge she was in her own homeland. It had been attacked only on rare occasions in the past. She was taken by surprise. Now she struggled to cope with the reality. The part of her mind that wasn't stunned was filled with anger. How dare that man come in here and start waving guns around and shooting? What gave him the right? The twisted, fanatic beliefs plaguing his diseased mind was the answer. What the terrorists were doing made perfect sense to them. That was why you couldn't negotiate with people like them. They lived in a universe stuck in a primitive, millennial-old barbarism. They shared no common frame of reference with normal, rational people. They might as well live in a world where the sky was a different color, green or purple, where people walked backwards and spoke through their ears. That was why you couldn't negotiate with people like them. Yet, if you couldn't talk to them, couldn't reason with them, couldn't even communicate with them, really, what did that leave? Terry knew the answer. If she'd had a gun right now, she would give her answer loud and clear. She learned how to shoot when she was a girl, and long sessions with Jack at the firing range improved her skill. Put a gun in her hand, she could plant a bullet right between that bastard's eyes. No problem. That is, if she could bring herself to pull the trigger, knowing it would end another human being's life. It was a frightening new question for her. So as she lay there on the cool tiles of the floor, she took a second to consider the question. Could she kill in order to save her daughter, herself, or any of those other innocent folk? Damn right she could. There was not an ounce of doubt in Terry McCabe's mind. But she didn't have a gun, and she couldn't fight the guy barehanded, not while he had those two machine pistols. She worked out enough on self-defense moves with Jack. He taught her a lot of what he learned from his special forces training, so she figured she would stand a good chance against the terrorist in a hand-to-hand fight, but only if he was unarmed. So, how was she going to get those pistols out of his hands?
Mom, what are we gonna do? Right now, we'll just do what that man says and wait to see what happens.
Do you think Dad's all right?
Terry was about to answer when the terrorist swung one of the guns toward them.
No talking!
Terry swallowed and tightened her arm around Ronnie. She gave the man a curt nod to show she understood the command and would follow it. Ronnie's question started more wheels clicking over in Terry's brain, though. Since she didn't get to talk to Jack during their brief phone connection, she didn't know if he was inside the store somewhere or still outside. If he was outside, he was probably aware by now of what was happening, and he would be going crazy knowing she and Ronnie were in here and in danger. He would want to get in, but surely the authorities would prevent him. But if he was inside, taken hostage too, then it was only a matter of time before he did something to try to turn the tables on his captors. She knew her husband. She knew him better than anyone on the face of the earth. There was no way Jackknife McCabe would allow himself to be held prisoner by a bunch of terrorists for long. He would fight back, and he would probably get killed. Terry closed her eyes for a second and told herself not to think like that. As she did, yet another possibility occurred to her. What if Jack was inside the store, but not taken prisoner? If he was loose, had somehow managed to escape the terrorists' notice, then he would be a wild card in their plans. A big wild card, because he spent years of his life battling their kind. He knew how to beat them. He knew how to kill them.
Everyone together now! Move together, over there! Move, move, move!
The man waved the automatic weapons to emphasize the command.
Crawl over to each other. Huddle together as closely as you can.
He didn't want them spread out. He wanted them grouped, easier for him to watch them. It must have occurred to him that if they charged him from several directions at once, he wouldn't be able to stop all of them. Many of the hostages would die, but in the end, he would be overwhelmed. Nobody wanted to be one of the ones who died, though, so the prisoners slowly began to cooperate, crawling together in one of the main aisles. The terrorist stalked along, checking the aisles in shoes and crafts, herding the hostages together like sheep. Terry, Ronnie, Allison Sawyer, and Ellis Burke were already in the main aisle, so they didn't have to move.
We shouldn't be doing this. We shouldn't be cooperating.
Then what should we do? He'll kill us all if we don't go along with what he says. You know that.
If we all rushed him at once...
He'd kill half of us. Do you want your daughter to die, Mrs. McCabe?
Terry just glared at him.
Anyway, you heard the shooting in the other parts of the store. This guy isn't alone. Even if we got him, the others would get us. He's probably got a bomb strapped to him, too. So if we jump him, he'll just set it off and blow us all to kingdom come.
A bomb?
Burke had his arm around Allison. He tightened it.
Don't worry. We'll get out of this all right. We'll just play along with that maniac and his friends, and eventually, they'll let us go.
How do you know that?
Even in this situation, the lawyer managed to smirk.
Because I know how negotiations work. They'll ask for something, they're bound to want something, or they wouldn't be doing this. And when they get it, they'll let us go.
How do you know the authorities will give them what they want?
Please. Nobody's gonna risk the lives of the hostages. This isn't Israel, you know.
No, it certainly wasn't. Talking solved nothing when you were dealing with lunatics. Terry understood that. That was why she knew Burke was wrong. The authorities, from the local level all the way up to the White House, could give the terrorists everything they wanted, and the sick bastards would still be capable of killing everyone in the Ultramegamart, including themselves. There was only one way to ensure the innocent people in here lived to see another day. Kill the sick bastards first. She knew her husband would be thinking the exact same thing.
Jack, be careful.
Who the hell are you? You one of them?
Relief went through McCabe as he realized that the only accent in the voice behind the gun pointing at him was pure Texan. There was something familiar about it, too.
No, sir.
The stranger crouched in the shadows alongside him and lowered his gun.
I can't see all that well back here, but I didn't think you was one of them nuts. I could tell by your voice you ain't. What's your name?
Jack McCabe. I'm a truck driver for Megamart.
McCabe held back about being ex-Special Forces.
One of my boys, huh?
Your boys.
But McCabe had already figured out who the man with the gun was.
Well, I'm Hiram Stackhouse.
Yes, sir. We've met a few times.
And what'd you say your name was?
Jack McCabe.
Oh, good Lord. I remember you now. I tried to hire you for my security force, but you wasn't having none of it. Said you wanted to drive a truck. What are you doing here?
Get down, you pig! Get down!
McCabe was about to answer when there was a sudden commotion at the far end of the stockroom. They couldn't see what was going on, but they could hear. McCabe's jaw tightened. He knew what that last sound meant. He heard it often enough back in the day. He caused it more than a few times during his career as an operator. It was the sound of some poor bastard dying from a slashed throat.
What?
McCabe stopped the older man with a hand on his arm.
You see what will happen if you do not cooperate. If you fight back, or if you disobey orders, you will die like this infidel dog.
Oh, bastards just killed one of my boys.
McCabe gave him a grim nod. One of the workers tried to jump the terrorists and got his throat slashed for his efforts. McCabe closed his eyes for a second, but it didn't help. In his mind, he saw the sudden spurt of blood from the jugular, a crimson fountain that quickly formed a coppery-smelling pool around the dead man. Once seen, a man never forgot such an image. McCabe knew he would never forget those he saw. They were part of him now, like his DNA. But he had planned to spend the rest of his life without ever having to see anything like that again. That would teach him to make plans. Too damn often, life had other ideas. McCabe forced his mind back to his predicament and leaned closer to the billionaire entrepreneur.
Look, we can't stay here. If they search again, they're gonna find us.
He nodded toward the near end of the stockroom, where a wall of offices stood,
Let's see if we can get in there. I'll bet they've done a sweep of the offices already, so maybe they won't check them again for a while.
Stackhouse nodded. On hands and knees, they crawled along the narrow space behind the mountain of crated-up TV sets. They only had to cover 50 yards or so, but it was a long 50 yards. About halfway there, they had to cross a 12-foot-wide opening where two of the double-swinging doors opened out into the main store. The doors were closed at the moment, but each of them held a large plexiglass window. If one of the terrorists happened to be on the other side of those doors and happened to glance through the clear plexiglass at the wrong time, well, it was an unlikely possibility, but a possibility nonetheless.
Don't waste any time getting across there, and stay low.
He was struck by the irony of him giving orders to the man who paid his salary. A man who was worth so much more than McCabe, it wasn't worth figuring. Stackhouse didn't seem to think anything of it, though. He nodded and did as McCabe told him. Crouching to stay below the windows and the swinging doors, and darting across to the point where the narrow aisle continued along the wall, behind shelves and stacks of assorted merchandise. McCabe waited until Stackhouse was safely concealed back there again, then hurried across himself. McCabe wished he could do something to help the stockroom guys, but for now, they would have to wait. He and Stackhouse needed to get somewhere safe so they could catch their breath and start putting together a plan for dealing with this threat. Stackhouse had a revolver of some sort. McCabe saw it, stared down its barrel. McCabe's only weapon was a pocket knife. So, there were the two of them, armed with one gun and one knife, against a couple of dozen terrorists with automatic weapons, and for all McCabe knew, bombs. Shouldn't be that difficult, McCabe thought wryly. The terrorists left the door open into the stockroom supervisor's office. The upper half of the wall looking out into the stockroom was glass, but the bottom half was solid. McCabe and Stackhouse went to their hands and knees to crawl there. To reach the door, they had to come out into the open. A central aisle separated the piles of merchandise, running all the way from one end of the stockroom to the other. If the terrorists turned around and looked, they would be able to see the two men slipping into the office.
Allahu Akbar! God is great and will deliver the victory to us, you cowering pigs!
You are not worthy to eat the dung on my shoe! You and your evil will be wiped away! The hand of Allah will grind you into dust! Death is too merciful for you unbelievers!
From the sounds at the other end, McCabe figured the terrorists were still haranguing the hostages. He slid past Stackhouse and ventured a look. Both terrorists had their backs turned. Without taking his eyes off them, McCabe flipped a hand at Stackhouse.
Go!
Stackhouse went, scurrying through the door into the office without wasting any time or making a sound. McCabe was right behind him. He turned to his left as soon as he was through the door and sat with his back pressed against the half wall under the window. Stackhouse was beside him.
Do not move. Close those doors.
McCabe breathed a little easier now, even though the overall situation was as perilous as ever. As long as he and Stackhouse stayed low, the terrorists couldn't see them without walking all the way down here from the other end of the stockroom. If they did that, McCabe and Stackhouse would hear them coming, because footsteps echoed in the cavernous room whenever somebody wasn't trying to be quiet.
Well, we're in quite a fix, ain't we, McCabe?
Yeah, you could say that.
Those boys are Arab terrorists, aren't they?
Well, they're Islamic, all right, but they may not be Arabs.
Sounds like you know something about this sort of shit. Used to be a spy, didn't you?
I was Special Forces. I didn't work for the company. And how the hell do you remember anything about me? You probably have hundreds of thousands of people on your payroll.
Yeah, just about. But I pay special attention to fellas with security backgrounds. A fellow who's worth as much money as I am needs to have good people around him. People who are loyal and hard asses, too. I figured you'd qualify if you hadn't been so damn stubborn about wanting to drive a truck.
I was retired from the other stuff.
Well, you ain't anymore. I reckon you're right back in that line of work.
McCabe was afraid Stackhouse was right. There was probably no one else inside the Ultra Mega Mart who was as qualified as he was to fight back against the fanatics who took over the store.
What are you doing here anyway? I thought you weren't supposed to be on hand for the celebration until later in the day.
Well, I like to show up early. Helps me weed out employees who don't like to work any time except when the boss is around. Keeps everybody on their toes.
McCabe looked over at him. Stackhouse didn't give the appearance of a man worth billions of dollars. a man who was in charge of the biggest retail organization in the world, a man whose business contributed more to the country's economy than any other private enterprise in history. No, in boots, jeans, and a long-sleeved cowboy shirt with pearl snaps, Hiram Stackhouse looked more like a farmer or rancher than an entrepreneur. He was in his 70s, but still healthy and vital, with a ruddy face and a shock of silver hair. He could be brusque and domineering, but he also had a folksy charm that made people like him, even when they didn't always agree with everything he did. And not one penny of his fortune was inherited. He built his business empire himself, from the ground up.
Where's your security people right now?
They got rounded up out there with the others. I think I'm paying those boys a little too much.
How come the terrorists didn't get you too?
I was in the back of the can taking care of business.
They didn't check the bathroom.
They did, but not before I climbed up on one of the walls around the stall, pushed up a ceiling tile, and climbed into the crawl space.
How did you know to do that?
I heard the shooting and yelling. I knew something was mighty wrong. First, I just figured it was another kidnapping attempt. My bodyguards have fought off a couple of those over the years, believe me. But it turned out to be even worse, though. I barely got that ceiling tile back in place when I heard somebody come in, and a couple of seconds later, he hollered something in an accent that didn't sound like anything American. I knew then that the shit had really hit the fan. I stayed where I was for a few minutes and I climbed down. Figured I'd take a look and see how bad things really are. I was working my way down to the other end of the stockroom when I came across you.
What were you gonna do? Take on a whole gang of terrorists with one revolver?
Well, I hadn't quite figured it out yet. I'll tell you one thing, though. It really chaps my ass to see them tailheads running around giving orders and hurting my people.
McCabe didn't like it either. He gestured toward the gun Stackhouse wore, tucked behind his belt.
Why are you carrying that anyway? Because of those kidnappers you mentioned?
Yeah. And because I like packing heat, too.
McCabe always figured Stackhouse's colorful personality was largely a put-on, a show for reporters and news cameras. But clearly, what you saw was what you got with Hiram Stackhouse. McCabe wouldn't mind having a whole bunch of Stackhouse's private army here right about now. Things might have been different. Or maybe not, if the terrorists had explosives. That would put a whole new angle on things.
What are we gonna do?
You're asking me? You're the billionaire here.
Oh, son, I know about making money and selling folks what they need for lower prices than just about anybody else, but I don't know diddly squat about fighting terrorists. That's your department.
Well, I don't know yet. I haven't figured it out.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't spend too much time thinking about it. The rest of the world knows by now what's going on in here. A jillion cops will be storming the place soon, and then all hell's gonna break loose.
No, nobody's gonna storm the place. Not with 1,000 or more hostages inside. Not until they found out what the terrorists want and have stalled for as much time as possible.
Now, what do those bastards want?
God, I don't know. I have no idea. We may be the last to know, but I'm sure they're going to be telling the world very soon if they haven't already.
Shala Sahi held up the cell phone, angling it so its camera lens caught the lean, bearded image of Sheikh Al-Mukari.
They are seeing this at the television station now?
They are. I spoke to their news director just a moment ago. He can see and hear you, and your message is being recorded.
Thank you, my dear.
He looked directly into the lens.
I am Sheikh Mushaf al-Mukari. I am a proud member of Hizb ut-Tahrir, the Party of Liberation. I am speaking to all of you out there in the godless nation of America. Today, we have struck a blow for the glory of Allah and the cause of Islam. Today, you felt only a small sample of the pain my people feel at the hands of Western Zionist aggression and imperialism. The new crusade launched against my people by the infidels must now come to an end. My fellow freedom fighters and I are in control of this satanic monstrosity you call an ultra mega mart. Everyone in here is now our hostage, and if our demands are not met, they will die.
The Sheikh and Shala stood near the front of the store, at the end of a seemingly endless row of checkout stands, now empty of clerks and shoppers. The Sheikh nodded, and Shala turned, moving the cell phone slowly and steadily so the camera lens caught the scene. She paused on a group of a dozen men and women, some of them shoppers, the others Megamart employees. They were on their knees on the floor, their hands clasped behind their heads. Behind them stood one of the terrorists, a machine pistol in his hand. He wore no mask. His dark, bearded face was exposed for the world to see. Shala moved the phone again, so it showed one of the main entrances of the store, just a few feet from where she and Mukari stood. Another half-dozen hostages sat there cross-legged, their arms pulled behind their backs uncomfortably, and their wrists tied together. Directly in front of them was a small but powerful bomb, its components smuggled into the store under the jackets of several of the terrorists and assembled only after they took over the place. Shala turned the phone back toward the Sheikh.
You have seen for yourselves I speak the truth. I warn the authorities. The bombs placed at every entrance are armed and equipped with motion sensors. The sensors will detonate the bombs if anyone approaches them too closely. Such a blast will instantly kill the hostages placed near them. So, storm the place if you will. But know, if you do, you will be killing your own people. Now, as to what we want, it is quite simple, really. The United States must immediately withdraw its warships from the Persian Gulf and cease its unlawful interference with the affairs of the sovereign state of Iran. In addition, all U.S. military forces must be withdrawn from Saudi Arabia and all Muslim countries. There must be no American boots on Islamic soil. Also, Americans engaged in business in Muslim countries will depart immediately, and all American business interests in those countries will be turned over to the caliphate established by Hizb ut-Tahrir. These demands also apply to the military and business interests of all other Western nations, as well as America. The caliphate, the new Islamic order, must be completely free of the taint of Western corruption and godlessness. It is a new day, the first day of the Holy Caliphate that will rule over all of Islam and, in time, the world, forever erasing the stench of the godless. Meet our demands with no delay, or else the hostages in this place will be destroyed with cleansing fire. Allahu Akbar!
Shala closed the phone, ending the transmission.
Do you think they got all that?
They got it. Now, what will they do about it?
Also,
the Oval Office was crowded again. The president sat in her chair, watching the TV monitor wheeled in front of the big desk. In chairs arranged in wings that curved away from the desk sat the usual suspects. The Vice President, Secretary of State, Secretary of Defense, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, National Security Advisor, Attorney General, Director of the FBI, Director of the CIA, Secretary of Homeland Security, White House Chief of Staff, and White House Press Secretary. Everybody who was anybody in the decision-making process. A council of war, although the President would not want to hear it described as such, given her anti-war background. The president's husband slouched in his usual chair in the corner, eyes heavy-lidded with apparent weariness, but actually alert and taking in everything. From where he was, he could see the TV screen. As the image of Sheikh Mushaf al-Mukari faded, only to be replaced by a grim-faced network anchor, the president muted the sound and waited. Every head in the room swung toward her, but no one spoke. Clearly, they were all waiting for her to take the lead.
Well, ideas?
Again, a strained silence filled the Oval Office, broken at last by the Secretary of Defense.
We can't withdraw all of our forces from the Middle East. We just can't.
Can't? Or just choose not to?
She looked at the chairman of the JCS.
How long would such a withdrawal take?
Days at best. More likely weeks. Maybe as long as a month. Those terrorists aren't going to squat in that store for a month.
I agree, but maybe if we began the process of withdrawing our forces, that would be enough of a show of good faith to convince them to release the hostages, some of them anyway. Do we know how many there are?
She turned to the director of the FBI.
It's impossible to get an accurate count, but estimates place the number upward of 1,000 shoppers. Counting the employees, there could be as many as 1,500 innocent people being held prisoner in there.
The Secretary of Homeland Security chimed in.
By the time they get through counting the bodies at the sites of those bombings, the death toll will probably be over 100.
Then even if we lose the store, it won't be as many people as died on 9/11. It won't be as bad as what happened on Bush's watch.
The president's husband grimaced. Nobody in the room said anything about the callousness of the president's comment or the political tunnel vision prompting it, but he knew some of them were thinking it anyway. He'd have to have a talk with her before she went on the air to issue a statement. If she got in front of the network news cameras and said, "Yeah, this is bad, but what happened when the other guy was president was worse," the country would turn against her.
What about the business angle? Can we convince American companies with holdings in the Middle East to divest them? Maybe that would be enough to satisfy the terrorists without the military withdrawal.
You'll never get them to go along with it. You're talking about billions and billions of dollars at stake.
Can we force them to comply? Maybe issue an executive order?
The president's husband had to risk speaking up. He did a lot of traveling and fundraising. He knew the CEOs of all the top companies in the United States on a first-name basis.
If you do that, you'll have a real crisis on your hands. You can't force an American company to turn over its holdings to a bunch of terrorists.
American companies have been nationalized by foreign countries before.
Yeah, in those cases, it was a foreign government doing the nationalizing, and we didn't like it. What you're talking about would be us doing it to our own people. They won't stand for it.
They stand for having to work more than half the year just to pay all their taxes.
But it took more than 40 years to reach that point. The process was slow enough so people just shrugged and went along with it when they noticed it all.
The president fidgeted with a pencil on the desk.
Then if we can't give the terrorists what they want, how can we convince them to release the hostages? Would it do any good to promise them amnesty? Perhaps provide them with a safe way out of the country?
What about a reprimand or even sanctions against Israel for that raid on Iran? That would certainly show our good faith and...
What the hell is wrong with you people? You're sitting around here trying to figure out the best way to let those terrorist bastards win.
We have the lives of all those hostages to consider.
Then with all due respect, ma'am, you should be trying to figure out a way to rescue them and kill the criminals who have taken over the store instead of asking yourselves how bad a screwing do we have to take in order to convince them to play nice.
You are out of line.
No, ma'am. The thinking in this country is out of line. No sooner had we gone into Iraq than the press and a certain segment of politicians began carping about what our exit strategy should be. There's only one acceptable exit strategy in a war. Win the damned thing. Let the losers worry about exit strategies.
You think we shouldn't have pulled out of Iraq?
I think we shouldn't have gone in unless we were prepared to win. But once we were in there, retreating just turned the country over to the bad guys and made them stronger than ever. The previous administration made the rest of the world mad at us, yes. But your administration, ma'am, has made the rest of the world sneer at us in contempt. I'd rather have the rest of the world mad at us rather than contemptuous of us. And I'd sure as hell rather have our enemies afraid of us instead of scornful of us, knowing we don't have the stomach to put up a real fight anymore. Of course, that appears to be the truth, at least in this room.
You're fired.
The NSA reached for her briefcase.
No, ma'am. I quit the minute you started talking about how we could best go about giving in to the terrorists' demands. You just didn't know it yet. You prissy little bitch.
With that, she turned and stalked out of the Oval Office, leaving a stunned silence in her wake. Finally, the president slumped back in her chair. She visibly struggled to bring herself under control.
All right. Now that we're all on the same page again, let's find an answer to this problem. Options? For God's sake, somebody has to have an idea!
The director of the CIA straightened in his chair.
Madam President, I don't have any suggestions regarding how you should handle this crisis, but a thought did occur to me while we were watching the tape of the Sheikh's statement.
What's that?
Well, he told you his name and showed you his face. The other terrorist we saw wasn't disguised in any way either. We should be able to figure out who he is without any trouble.
So?
Terrorists usually wear hoods or masks of some sort to conceal their identities. These guys don't care if we know who they are.
And what does that mean?
It means they're not planning on coming out of there, whether you give them what they want or not. This is a suicide. They want to be martyrs. They want to die for the caliphate.
My God, how do we negotiate with people like this?
No one said anything, but they all knew the answer to her question.